Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you all for coming. It's great to have such a good group together this afternoon to talk about what I think is one of the most important subjects as we look out, especially over the next 3 to 5 years, over what's going to happen on both supply and demand. We welcome you on behalf of the Energy and National Security Program here. My name is Guy Caruso, for those I haven't met. And the focus, purpose of today really is to look at the upstream and the impact of the weak global economy and the financial crisis on investment in the oil and gas exploration and development. I know that when one tries to look at the real bottom line question, which is, are we going back into a cycle where lack of investment in the upstream leads to upward pressure on price once again? We also need to look at the demand side as well. But today we really want to examine the upstream side and leave the demand side for perhaps another session. I know we're going to have the International Energy Agency folks here in about 2 weeks, Frank? June 30th, to talk more generally about the short to medium term outlook. And I'm sure we'll talk a bit about demand as well at that, and Adam's going to touch on it a bit in his presentation as well. And we've really got an excellent panel to examine this issue this afternoon. Just to perhaps frame the issue, put a few numbers out there. The International Energy Agency made a presentation before the G8 energy ministers in Rome last week about the impact of the economic recession and financial crisis on investments in energy. And this is the estimate that the IEA is currently making about where upstream oil and gas expenditures are likely to come about in 2009, and they're estimating a more than a 20% decline in upstream expenditures based on a survey of a large number of companies that they've taken. And I think it's interesting to look at that survey because there's a very significant difference among the classes of companies. For example, the large majors, international oil company majors, relatively little change in their capital expenditure outlook for 2009 relative to 2008. Similarly, national oil companies like Saudi Aramco and Kuwait Petroleum Company and others, not a huge expectation of decline in upstream investment, but a real sharp decline when you start moving down into medium-sized and smaller companies which have larger debt-equity ratios. That, to me, means that they're part of the problem, at least, and I look to Susan and Adam to you know, their thoughts on the issue of availability of capital to some of these smaller and medium-sized companies in both the oil and gas investments. And there's clearly a difference among the various sized companies with respect to expectations of capital expenditures based on their source of capital. If there is a good news part of the estimates of capital expenditures for 2009 is that there is a cost decline that the IEA in its report and a number of others have identified, and that is steel and concrete and other infrastructure used in the exploration and development. Costs have come down a bit after having doubled in the period between 2000 and 2008. And then specifically within the companies that I mentioned, the regional disparities are pretty clear, and that is things like Canadian oil sand projects, very heavily affected by the combination of slower economy, lower expectation of demand, and higher cost of capital or difficulty of obtaining capital. So we'll talk about a number of these things, and including the challenge that Frank Verastro and others on the energy team here at CSIS have been highlighting for some time now, and that this huge investment challenge of meeting both rising expectations for demand, which are in this case are shown the International Energy Outlook just released last week by the EIA, shows rising demand up to over 100 million barrels a day of total liquids, combined with the usual expectation of the normal decline rate. In this case, we're looking at 4 to 7% decline rates in the older fields. There is a definite we have picked up in discussions with companies and in research that the decline rates could well be affected by a slower investment in the upstream, and could be more like 7% average decline rate relative to 4, and that again means that more investment will be required to meet the demand. In this case, it's shown here about 10 years out, the need for almost 30 million on the low end to 50 million on the high end of new capacity to make up for both growth in demand and the decline rate. So those are issues that I think we'll hopefully talk about in the session today. And one of the important uncertainties is the shape of the recovery and what that means for demand for petroleum and other liquids. You know, there was hope at one time we would see a V-shaped normal recovery from this recession. I think most economists are now, consensus among most economists now is more like a U-shaped. And even with that, you can see we're looking at perhaps a couple more years of much slower growth globally, macroeconomic growth, as well as growth in liquids demand. Real pessimists see extended long-term low growth, or you could be looking at the W shape. So the demand uncertainty clearly plays into the picture and has important role in the question of are we going to be back into another one of the investment cycles where prices, there'll be upward pressure on price once again if insufficient investment in the upstream combined with perhaps a strong growth, particularly in emerging economies. But that's what our three panelists are going to address today is you know, what is the real impact of this recession and the financial credit tightness on the upstream part of the oil and gas industry. We've got three outstanding speakers. We're going to lead off with Adam Siminski, who's the chief energy economist for Deutsche Bank and has been working with that bank and a number of other financial institutions on energy markets for a number of years there. You have in your handout more detail about each of the speakers. Susan Farrell will then follow Adam, who's she's a senior director at the Petroleum Finance Corporation, PFC's energy upstream and gas practice, and has had extensive experience in working and analyzing the service sector and working with large international oil companies as well as national oil companies, and has a great perspective on that difference in how this current economy has affected the different classes of companies. And finally, Alan Crane is Senior Vice President for Baker Hughes, the largest drilling contractor in the world, operating in almost 100 countries. So they've got a real unique perspective on the direct effect of this downturn on the actual drilling rates. And we all hear about the Baker Hughes drilling rig count and index, and it's down significantly, especially in this country and especially in gas. And Alan has had considerable experience not only at Baker Hughes but also in other parts of the upstream oil and gas business. So, Adam, if I could ask you to lead off, I'd appreciate it. Thank you very much. Please welcome Adam Zeminski.
Okay. Well, Guy, thank you very much for that introduction. Frank Barastro and the whole team here at CSIS and the Energy and National Security Program, appreciate the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here with Alan and Susan. So the trick here is going to be to go through this really fast so that we don't eat up all of the time of the other panelists, and I'm going to promise to do this in 15 minutes. All right. Who's got a big hook out there? How low could the economy go? The IMF view actually sort of looks like a V-shaped recovery. Guy, they're talking about a minus 1.3% global GDP growth this year, followed by just a little bit less than 2% next year. The long-term average GDP growth rate, if you go back over the last 30 or 35 years, is probably on the order of 3.5%. Would be a little bit higher than that if we included the last 5 years or so, but I think the last 5 years really weren't very representative. So GDP this year down somewhere in the order of 1.3%, says the IMF. The Deutsche Bank view of the global economy is a little bit worse than that. We're saying in that middle column there, the bottom line, minus 1.7%. Now, the interesting thing to me about that 1.7 is that 6 weeks ago it was minus 1.9, and then 2 weeks ago it was minus 1.8, now it's 1.7. So I think mathematicians would call that the second derivative. The second derivative is turned positive. So it's less worse. I think that's the word. It's not really getting better. It's bad. But it's not as bad as we thought it was going to be. Our forecast for 2010 is 2.3%. Our U.S. economist is saying, just based on the numbers, the most recent data coming out of the U.S., that the U.S. could end up a little bit higher in the third and fourth quarters than he had in his numbers. He's not ready to change them yet. But it would still be, you know, highly negative. It might be minus 2.5% instead of minus 3.2%. Keep the minus 1.7, you know, in the back of your head for a second. We'll come back to it. Alan asked me, he said, are you going to show this slide, Adam? And I usually have another one at this point, but I said, yeah, we can do this. Look at that. I mean, what's the world slowdown doing to, you know, if the question is what's the impact of a weak economy, you know, on oil? Well, demand has really gone down a lot. And the 2009, if you go back to, I think it was August of last year when the IEA first came out with their forecast for 2009, they thought demand would be, you know, a little over 87.5 million barrels a day. We're now down to 83 million barrels a day. I mean, we've lost 4.5 million barrels a day of demand in this downturn. You know, you say, well, what are we really losing on a year-over-year basis? And I've got a rough model. I'd be happy to talk later about this, anybody who wants to talk about it. But if you want to know what oil demand is going to be, just subtract 2% from GDP. Don't use a factor, just a constant term. Just subtract 2%. So whatever your GDP forecast, if your GDP forecast is minus 1.5, then oil demand will probably go down about 3.5%. And that's kind of in the ballpark of where the International Energy Agency is. You already saw this slide. This is the IEA's view of what's going on with upstream oil and gas capital expenditures. As Guy said, down 21%. They're also talking about a nearly 40% decline in financing for renewables. So big hits on wind and solar. You know, one of the interesting ways to think about this is that in the inevitable cycles that we have in oil and gas pricing where the prices run up, we get lots of money pouring into oil and gas, traditional and unconventional, and we also get a lot of money going into alternative energy like renewables. And then in the inevitable downturn, you know, so we get new ideas coming, new ideas in geology, new ideas in renewables, and then with the downturn, we wash out the bad ideas. And so that's, I think, is probably what's happening. You know, is there any good news? What's the outlook for the global economy? So here's something that you've probably heard of, but it's the Baltic Dry Freight Index. And this is basically, this is how much it costs to move a ship with containers on it from somewhere in the world to somewhere else in the world. So it's an index, but think of about, this is what it cost to get widgets from China to, you know, California so that we can consume them here. And that got down to, you know, it's nearly all-time low there. That yes, last time we saw was, well, it's not all-time, but January 2002. It's actually starting to come back a little bit. So the Baltic Dry Freight Index is suggesting that ships are beginning to move again on the high seas, taking goods around. Consumer sentiment. Guy talked about the W-shaped recovery. Consumer sentiment has sort of had that W-shape. We've had fits and starts, but the latest couple of months of consumer sentiment data say that it looks like it's going back up again. So that's pretty good. The ISM, so the manufacturing index and the durable goods data are also suggesting in the last month and a half, 2 months, I guess, that it looks like we bottomed and we're going back up again. So the economy maybe is starting to recover. And if we bring that back to the oil area, you could say gasoline demand looks like it's starting to do better. I mean, we had a horrible low with the hurricane, and we could probably exclude that. But if you look at the period in October, November, December, gasoline demand was falling on a year-over-year basis at about 3% or so. And that's now back to almost flat. Now, most recent weekly data is still showing a little bit of decline in gasoline demand, but not nearly as bad as it was 3 or 4 months ago. There's almost a little bit of a W shape there. I think that the first recovery in gasoline demand had to do with the fact that gasoline prices fell from $4 to $2. Now prices are back up. We're closer to $2.50. And at the same time, unemployment is rising. Incomes are coming down. And so we might now be seeing a little bit of a negative impact on gasoline from both price and income elasticities. That's probably why it's not positive again yet. So the next three slides, I'm just going to give you a really quick thought on, well, if the economy is as bad as it is and if demand is down, you know, 3% or more, why are oil prices going up? Why are commodity prices going up? This section of the presentation is dedicated to Secretary Schlesinger, who asked this very question this morning of Frank Verastro. So I don't know exactly what Frank said. I hope we're not too far off. Well, first of all, there's been a really pretty strong correlation since last September between the S&P 500 and oil prices, right? The S&P 500 is a big equities index. It's a stock market. Think of it that way. The stock market went down and oil went down, the stock market, you know, started to go up and oil started to go up. Why is that? The stock market itself is reflecting a view that says the economy is going to get better. We're not going to be in that L-shaped depression forever. So the economy is going to get better, and the stock market tends to be a leading indicator. So 6 months might be a little early, but it's reflecting that ahead of time. And so we're seeing a lift in the S&P 500. Not only that, but we've seen some really incredible moves in the U.S. dollar. Now, there's a long academic history of the dollar and oil and gold are related. And the dollar moves inversely to oil and gold. And I saw, in fact, there was an obit in the paper this morning Dr. Granger passed away, the Granger causality test. And Dr. Granger showed that there was a way statistically to say what drives what. And Granger causality tests on this say that the dollar tends to drive oil and gold, not the other way around. So the dollar, that's a reverse scale there for the dollar. That's the cost of a euro. The top is 160, the bottom is 120. You know, how much it costs you to buy a euro. So at $1.60, you don't want to go to Europe for your vacation, right? As the dollar went up, oil prices were going up. And then the dollar began to strengthen. So that's the down move on that reverse scale. And oil fell with it. We've had a couple of little blips in there. But recently, the dollar has gotten very, very weak. We're at 142 or 143 this morning, dollar-euro rate, and oil has gone up. So oil is going up because it's being driven there by the dollar, and oil is going up because it's being moved along in the same way the stock market is being moved along by enthusiasm for the economy. And if that's not enough, there's this final reason, and there's a flow of funds argument. I'm not as convinced of the flow of funds argument as I am of the other two, because this one leads you immediately to, well, is that investment or is that speculation? And I'm not really sure that speculation drives oil prices. In fact, I'm pretty sure it doesn't. But what you see there, that last peak, the one on the left, was in June of 2008. That's how much money was invested in a suite of index products that Deutsche Bank sells to clients. So we have the numbers on this. They're internal. But this is a summary of all that stuff. And what we saw is that currently there's more money invested in commodities today than there was in June of 2008. But commodities prices are lower. So those of you who are really quick with the math will be able to say, aha, that means there's actually more money coming in, more people voting, in a sense, that commodities look like a useful investment than there were back in June of 2008. So the total amount invested is higher than where it was back in June. So money is coming in there. I think that that provides some temporary support. Ultimately, commodities, you know, futures markets converge every month to spot prices when the contract expires. And somebody real is buying those real barrels at the end of the month. And my view is that the people who are buying those barrels ultimately are the ones that are setting the price, not the futures market. What price are E&P stocks discounting? I picked this one because it's really interesting. Just look out in the stock market, and you can do a reverse calculation which says if people are paying X amount for the stock of a company like Chesapeake Energy or any of the others, Devon Energy, or the big companies, you can work backwards and say what price assumption is built into that. And Shannon Noem, who does this work for us down in our Houston office, says that the E&P stocks are reflecting about $7 natural gas and about $70 oil. That's kind of what the futures market is saying, too. We'll come back to that. I want to go back to another slide from the IEA, and we're getting very close to the end of the slide package here. The IEA says that this is what CO2 emissions are going to look like out to the year 2030. If we have the business-as-usual case, we're going to grow from roughly 30 gigatons of carbon dioxide now to about 40 in that time frame. Ideally, we're trying to hold this number down closer to 25 gigatons. But you can see a big part of the increase comes from oil and gas consumption. So, I mean, I'm going to kind of do a reverse thought on you here. Maybe the idea that not enough money is being invested in oil and gas to provide the supply is a good thing. You know, you can look at it that way. What you could say is that means prices will be higher, consumption will be lower, and it kind of goes to this idea that Guy actually mentioned at the introduction of we really ought to think very carefully about the demand side of what's going on in oil and gas investments as well as just what we think is happening on the supply side. In thinking about carbon, there a huge amount of effort is going into the idea of getting rid of carbon-based fuels, all right? So that's coal, oil, and natural gas. And yet what we've seen in the Waxman-Markey legislation markup is that immediately going to a very high carbon price puts coal-fired electric utilities at a big disadvantage. And if you want to get the votes to pass carbon legislation, you have to make compromises. And one of those compromises is giving away allowances in the early years, which means that you're still going to have a lot of carbon going into the atmosphere. And one of the things that I think is just beginning to filter into the thinking of the political groups in Washington is the idea of the possibility of using what appears to be an amazingly prolific shale gas opportunity as a way to bridge the time frame between now and when we can move forward with carbon capture and sequestration of coal-fired electric utilities. Barnett Shale, Haynesville, Fayetteville, Woodward, the Marcellus up here in the northeast area. There are oil shale gas shale basins all over the United States. There's huge ones in Canada. In fact, they're all under Europe as well, which all of this has some really interesting implications. And maybe Alan can address this. I'll ask him about it during his presentation if he doesn't, is that the techniques developed by companies like Baker Hughes and others who are in this business have brought the cost down tremendously of developing these shale gases. And so what we thought was unconventional has really been turned around. The stuff that we thought was the high-priced unconventional has become the lower-priced, possibly conventional gas, and I'm not sure that it's been recognized politically the extent to which we might actually be able to boost our natural gas consumption in the U.S. Final slide, Guy. So I thought I would end up actually with giving you a summary of a fairly sizable paper that was written at the IMF recently, a working paper by a couple of the analysts over there on what determines investment in the oil sector. I thought, oh, that's a pretty good paper. I should read that. We're going to have to talk about it here this afternoon. And let me just go through a couple of these bullet points with you really quickly. So in the 1990s, low oil prices reduced investment, which then probably led to some of the spikiness that we saw in prices in this decade. But the combination of soaring costs, so everybody trying to drill wells at the same time, trying to develop projects at the same time, led to big increases in costs and maybe maintenance deferment, and that's translated actually into little real new investment. So it is kind of a problem. Limited geographical opportunities, and a lot of the countries may have also led to investment going in areas that wouldn't be ideal in a fully market-oriented global economy. So companies were taking greater technological risks. That, too, added to cost structures. So costs really went up a lot. And efforts by governments to increase taxes. So the greater the tax take, the less, ultimately, the benefit you get from any given level of investment. So what's the outlook on all of this? And what Valerie Mercer-Blackman concluded in this paper was is that technology, improvements in technology, would ultimately really help investment respond to any kind of a price environment. It was important to limit the obstacles to investment and to stabilize tax policies in governments everywhere, including our own, and that the potential impact that you could have of doing these things in the short term shouldn't be overestimated. It's a tough slog because you still do have geographic limitations. Let me put my own spin on this. I think what Valerie ultimately was saying is that, look, prices go up and then they come down and we get the investment and then we don't get it. But that ultimately technology drives costs lower, which allows a given level investment to generate more oil and gas supplies. That has worked pretty much in the past. I suspect it will work in the future. And with that, Guy, I will stop. Thanks.
Thank you, Adam.
Susan Farrell, PFC.
Thank you very much. That was a perfect intro to the next part, which is going to talk more about companies and how they decide whether they should invest or not. So as I was thinking about what to talk about in 15 minutes, I thought there were four big questions, and we'll see how far we get in them. Should we invest? Then there's can we invest? That's sort of a new question, and that's brought about by the financial crisis. There are companies now who can't invest. That's something new. Where should we invest? As the IMF paper evidently identified, there are limited opportunities around the world. And then there's also a second new question, should we invest now or later? The whole concept of the present value has changed a bit. And what used to be a God-given mathematical calculation that if you invested now, it was going to be better off for your net present value, that's no longer completely clear. So let me go first to the investment imperative in this business. Much of this you already know. This is a chart which looks at a number of regional and global and small players. The vertical axis is the production, and the horizontal axis is the reserves. So what it shows you is that there are these really big players, of course, Shell, BP, ExxonMobil out in the far right. In the middle, we've got some what we call regional majors. You have Statoil Hydro, ENI, Lukoil, and so forth. And then you have a whole bunch of little players down at the bottom, which we call focus players mostly here. We call them independents. And these companies have very different challenges. So the big companies, the global and the regional players, they have such materiality problems that they wake up every day wondering, where can we go that will make any difference? And I want to look at some of those in detail as well. These small players have a different issue. They have, can we invest? Do we have the money to? And where should we go to have a quick turnover? The smaller, this is a subsection of the smaller players, so you can spread them out and look at them a little bit more. Same axes again. And you can see that, again, there's a wide range of these companies. Many of them are located here. And some of them have some significant investment questions in front of them. But you look on the far upper right again, you have Encana, who is pretty much focused in North America. Then somewhere down to the left, you have Noble Energy, who has just had a huge find, huge gas find in Israel, so they're a very international company. So these are very different types of companies, a little bit more so than the global players, who all have this big materiality challenge. So how well have they done in actually replacing their production? I haven't got to that yet. Decline rates. So if those are the challenges, then what is impacting their decisions of where they should invest and whether they should invest? One is the decline rate. The interesting, really interesting part of this chart for us is it goes over an 8-year period when prices were rising. So we're looking at a decline rate, including and excluding the FSU. And the reason we exclude the FSU, so we need to look at the red line on top, is because there was so much to be done in the FSU that it sort of skewed your global look at average decline rate. And what you see is that over this time period, in spite of rising prices, where you would put any money you could into getting out the extra barrel from your existing production, we couldn't stem the decline rate. This is most definitely an industry which has a depleting resource. So if you're investing in this industry, you have to keep investing in order to get increasing production or stable production. Let's look at the deep water. And I'm looking at the deep water because it's one of the major new sources of oil plays in the last decade. And what we have here is a build-up chart which shows the decline rate from the year in which the fields came online. So it's all the deep water fields in the world aggregated for those that came online in each of those years. And the interesting part is, although it's a little hard to tell just looking at a picture, is if you count down four from the top, what you see is in 2005, 6, 7, and 8, the plateau got shorter. It sort of goes 4 years, 3 years, 2 years, 1 year. Now, some of that varies depending upon what countries came on and so on and what projects. But nonetheless, you are looking at your major new resource of having a 12% annual decline rate for those projects which are already in production after 2009. So even if you've gone after the deep water plays, which are very material for sure, you have a real replacement issue in front of you. Now, then there's the can we invest question. We've looked at probably 100 companies from, not the big players, but the medium-sized players, the independents, the service sector, in order to do some work trying to figure out what projects were going to be delayed and why. And what we uncovered, which we don't have time to go through here, but what we uncovered was a very big difference in the business models of companies. So we have a lot of very highly levered players. And depending upon where they got caught in their investments, they may or may not be able to continue with their capital program at the same rate at which they had anticipated, given that they can no longer have as much funding as they had anticipated. So who actually spends the money? This is a pie chart looking at 2008 upstream or exploration and production spend, which was about $500 billion, we estimate. And the top 20, as you can see from the chart, the top 20 IOCs and independents account for about 35%. The top 20 NOCs, national oil companies, account for about 30%. And then there are a whole other bunch of little companies, U.S., U.K., a lot of them, which account for 35%. That's the sector that is in the most financial distress, as you might imagine. We seem to have, each of us has this chart, evidently. This is our view of a selected number of IOCs that we've tracked. It's a little longer time frame since 1982, so we could get a consistent database. And what you can see is, if you look back at history, in these big downturns, you do get significant spending cuts. So this group of IOCs, which are equivalent, say, to the top 20, would probably drop their numbers by somewhere about 30%. So short-term response. Now, what we looked at the demand outlook given by Adam. What we're now looking at is a supply response. So you have a demand response to a recession, but you also have a supply response. So we're starting. So where the new inflection point is going to be is an interesting question. So here's a supply response. People are going to stop investing as much as they planned in the coming year. Now, some companies are going to disappear. We look back at the last big downturn for this industry, which is 1995. There was 79 independents that we could identify. And by 2007, more than half of them were gone. Is that going to happen this time? Well, probably something similar. Is it happening yet? Not quite. But, again, these are the types of companies which are probably in the most distress because they were pretty highly levered, many of them. I don't mean the ones on this chart in particular. Now, there's a problem with that in that those are the companies whose business model is to explore, not to buy other people in general. So they account for, the independents account for over half of exploration spend. This was sort of interesting. I didn't realize that until we started doing some of this work. So if you start taking out the independents, you're going to put a dent in the exploration spend, global exploration spend, which is going to, down the line, create what we call a portfolio gap. So if you don't explore and you don't find new things, then later on you have a portfolio gap. So independents are cutting their spending dramatically, but the majors are also slowing things down. They're not cutting nearly as much, for sure, as Guy talked about, but they are definitely slowing things down. It's sort of, if you're at the chairman of a board and you see a train wreck in front of you, maybe the first thing you do is, and you're driving the car, is to put your foot on the brake. You're not canceling anything, but you're going to reevaluate things. So we've looked at all the major projects around the world. This is just a timeline. With the end of the blue line here, and these happen to be Angolan projects, when the company says they'd like to come online, and beyond that is our different views, different probability weighted views of when they might come online. So you slow down projects. Again, another supply response. And then there are, of course, the Canadian oil sands, which really are very expensive. And these will be slowed down, and you get a supply response of, I think it's somewhere in the order of 1.5 million barrels a day by the time you get out to 2017 or so that wouldn't be coming on that had been planned to come on. Just one word about NOCs. Although we won't spend too much time on them at all, they are much more steady. They have entirely different drivers. They are vehicles of the state, by and large. And if you look at their capital expenditure plans for 2009, they have stayed pretty much stable. But they are really not a homogenous group. They're very heterogeneous. And as we look at them, some of them actually have quite a bit of money. Petronas has a huge amount of money. And there are some NOCs which are going to be in a very good position to make acquisitions as time goes on. There are others which are not so highly, they're more highly geared, so they're not don't have as much cash. And they're going to be looking for different sorts of partnerships and so on. And then there are the other ones like Saudi Aramco just going to power along with their plan and keep on course. So we've looked at should we invest? And the answer is yes, you have to invest. Otherwise, given the decline rates, you're unable to replace your production. Can we invest? There are some real questions on a number of the independents. Where would you invest? Let me take a minute to run through this. This is a look at the new portfolio production of a number of majors and independents over the next 5 or 6 years. So all their new source oil and gas production. On the left is the majors, broken into type of play. And on the right is the independents. So just to read it through, so if we look at the majors, we see that 28% of their new source production is conventional oil. And then they have a big big portfolio of deep water. They have LNG and GTL, a little bit of conventional gas, not a whole lot, EOR, oil sands, and unconventional gas, almost nothing. You look at the independents on the right, and you'll see not a reversal, but just look at the unconventional gas at the top. The big guys are just not in that play. The independents are highly in that play, most of it being, in this case, in the United States. Surprising amount of deep water because these are expensive developments, but the independents are most definitely in the deep water play. Very different portfolio choices. Just a look at the unconventional gas and how much that's actually done. This is just over a 3-year period. The only growth in gas in the Gulf in the U.S. has been in unconventional gas, and it's a little hard to see in this chart here, but if you just look at the numbers, so if you go from 40 up to nearly 50 billion cubic feet a day, that's a huge growth in unconventional, huge growth. Now, these are the same people who are under some financial stress and who are going to reduce their spending. Just a look at a different portfolio. If this is where the independents in the U.S. have been playing, just a look at a different portfolio going forward of a major. And I put this up because I wanted to show why people invest in LNG and oil sands. And what you get if you do that is not this sharp 12% decline of your deep water, but what you get is a very long, steady portfolio or production piece in your portfolio. So very expensive projects, but this is why you do it and what you get for it. So, again, very different choices of these different types of companies on investment. Now, should we invest now or later? That's an interesting question. It used to be always now because your present value is higher, as I said. But as was mentioned earlier, prices rose, yes, but costs went up dramatically. But in a 2-year period, this is a big Gulf of Mexico spar, one of those cylindrical offshore facilities, 52%. This is by segment. I didn't label them. I should have. So the bottom one is drilling. That's your single biggest component of a facility. And you can see, but all of the costs. So you have drilling, you have the facilities cost, you have the installation of the pipelines, you have the installation of the actual facility, engineering, project management, and so on. Everything went up, 52%. So although prices were rising, this was eroding, of course, your margins. Now, what price do you need to go forward? We looked at 46 deep water projects around the world, and we modeled them in great detail in order to see what they needed to get an internal rate of return for the development cost only. So consider the exploration cost sunk. What do you need to get a development internal rate of return of 20%? And what this showed was that, so the bottom, the dark blue, the bottom on is, these are number of projects. So at $60, well over half of the projects achieved a 20% rate of return or better. At 50, they didn't. So we've been at the inflection point of the decision of whether you invest or you don't. So the 50-60 is really important. 45 was not definitely not good. if you're going to require, given the risk, a 20% internal rate of return. So, again, a very volatile period, but right on the cusp of trying to make a decision of should you go forward or not. Costs matter. This, again, is the same concept of you take projects in different countries which have different fiscal regimes, and if you look at the internal rate of return at, say, $60, so we took the same $60, the vertical axis is the internal rate of return, and how it would change if you expected that you would have a reduction in cost. So first of all, you see the different levels of these countries reflects the fiscal regimes. So you look at Norway, really a high-cost area to do business because of the taxes. So you're going to have less internal retained return no matter what you do. But let's look at Angola, Nigeria, Brazil, U.S. And as you see, if you think there's going to be a 20, 25% cost reduction overall, then you are better off waiting. You're better off waiting. So if you thought you'd have a 25% internal rate of return, you think service sector costs are going to go down 20% over the next 18 months, say, you can raise your rate of return up to closer to 35%, 33%. So you're better off waiting. Very counterintuitive to people who are chief financial officers and accountants by trade. Now, experience also matters, and I'm almost finished as well here. And I just wanted to look at the Haynesville shale play. It turns out in the unconventional play, there are very big differences between good wells and not-so-good wells. And there are very big differences among the players, the small players. So these are five companies on the left-hand side. And they're all independents. None of them are big companies. And the initial production by operator, the best producer in Haynesville had an initial production of 20 million cubic feet a day, and the worst had less than 5. Well, if you translate that over, and the initial question for which we did this analysis was, can you make money at $4? Can you make money in the Haynesville at $4? And it turns out the answer is it depends upon who you are. So if you look at the break-even on the right, if you had an initial production of 10, so we have two companies who barely make that on the left, your break-even is $3.10. If you're at 5 and you've got a couple companies like that, then you don't. So big differences. Again, I'm trying to look at the investment decisions going forward. So depending upon where you are and who you are and what experience level you have, again, you're going to be on the cusp. You can be losing money here. I think this is the second slide we all have. This is the PFC view of out to the future of oil. And one of the reasons that people continue investing is that we have reset. Okay, the world has reset, meaning there's a big drop in demand. There's a supply response to go with it. But the new reset pushes you off in terms of a real tightening of supply demand. But it doesn't eliminate the issue of a depleting resource. So depending upon your view as an investor, the issue is you still think that you need to keep investing because you can see the future of a continuing rise in oil prices after one gets through this particular period. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Susan.
Alan?
I need some help with this computer. Can I do it, Matt? Didn't seem to want to close the whole thing. There we go. It's a little different on top. Just hit slideshow. Okay, then. Thanks. Okay, well, thank you. As Guy, or to follow Guy's introduction, for those of you who don't know me, my name is Alan Crane. For those of you who do know me, my name's still Alan Crane. As Guy mentioned, I have been in the E&P business on one side or the other for over 30 years, more than two-thirds of that on the exploration production side for the last 8 years with Baker Hughes on the service side, although I am also a director of a public E&P company on the New York Stock Exchange. a U.S.-based oil and gas producer. So I have a sort of a dual perspective, and I thought at Guy's request I'd try and cover both of those in some degree. More than anything, I want to say how pleased I am to be speaking at CSIS and in front of such a distinguished group of the audience here as well as our distinguished panel. It's a real honor. Baker Hughes has the rig count, as Guy mentioned to you, so I give you a draft here of looking at the cycles on rigs, just looking at rigs that are in the United States, and keep in mind most of the rigs in the United States are for gas-directed drilling, natural gas-directed drilling, and how since 1970, actually, how the different cyclical part of the business has been quite cyclical, and just comparing, put it in colors for each one. And if you look the main chart, you can see the different drops. And then if you go up, it shows you on the top right how quickly the most recent decrease has been. So it started out looking a lot like some of the prior years, but then has gone down very fast and models obviously off of the demand destruction that Adam showed in his chart. And then the bottom chart's percentage loss. And this is a few weeks old data, so it's even worse than it was in here today. The other thing that's different is the international cycle. That tends to be much lower. The international cycle of rigs, again, these are rigs, is primarily focused on oil drilling versus gas drilling. You see months instead of weeks like you see in the U.S., and that is different. The other thing that's different in this cycle, of course, is the economic situation worldwide, which is the focus of our discussion today. So there aren't the same factors driving the rest of the economies that impact on this. So just looking at the international, since the peak, we're down about 10% from peak activity. And, again, it's months rather than weeks, but we're not sure where it's going. We know in some places it's stronger, frankly. Latin America is pretty good, holding up pretty well. But places like Russia and the U.K. are seeing significant destruction. But it reinforces what a cyclical business this is, and particularly on the service side. This is a chart we use to look at demand, and I think Susan had a chart or at least spoke to how much capital expenditure there is. You'll see here we top it out at 350 because we're looking at available market for products that we play in, so not the whole half the 500 million that she was $500 billion that she was talking about. But the key is, and thing we watch very closely, is the difference between the demand and the supply. And if you look going back at 1983 compared to 2009, even though we see demand opening up again, as Adam showed, it's opening up, you're opening up from a much different base. So percentage-wise, in 83, you saw that the supply overhang was 24%, and now it's down. Certainly, we're still operating at least 90% of capacity. So you can see how it's still close up there in the top, and while it is increasing, it's still a lot tighter than it was as you go back in time. I think this chart was spoken to, and I just have a slightly different way of presenting it on the right-hand side, what it's made up of, but just like Susan showed, the producing fields, the decline rates are significant, and what else is going to come in to really fill that. So these are the projections on what will come in to get to that 100 million number that Guy also spoke to at the start. And will it all be there, and how will it get developed? And I'll speak a little bit about that in the context of technology. Here's some of the different types of projects that we work on and that can supply future hydrocarbons. You see in the lower left that which has already been produced. So the first trillion barrels of oil was produced very economically. The Middle East and North America, still fairly economic opportunities, other conventional oil. And then the pricing gets higher. So, it depends where you want to put your projected price, or what we call on the E&P side your price deck. Where do you think you're going to make money? The net present value is going to work out. And those are projected prices, not today's price. It's not last week's price. It's not a week from now or a month from now. It's where do you think that price deck is going to sit? And you draw a line and you say anything below that, I can do. Anything above that, I can't do, because I can't get the net present value. And timing comes in very importantly as to when you'll be producing it. And I very much agree with what Susan said regarding the production by the people that we do projects for. We are seeing slowdowns. People are doing a lot of maintenance. In fact, some people are, rather than saying that we're doing, slowing down a project, or just saying, well, we're doing lots of maintenance. They're doing a lot of maintenance in some places. So sometimes politically you can't say we're slowing something down, so it's very understandable to see that. Let me talk about how service companies are different. And I'm not just talking about the fact that service companies have access around the world to do projects. We do work in over 94 countries. So even an Exxon doesn't have the opportunity to go into a Saudi Arabia to work on classic oil and gas projects or any number of other countries where we're able to do a business, all in accordance with U.S. law, though. We don't go into places that the U.S. doesn't like us to go. I promise you that. But we're also different because of technology and what's evolved over certainly the past 20 years. The major oil field service companies are where the technology is. We have very advanced technology. We have very sophisticated people. We are global in scope. We have project management capabilities, so we can do projects for anybody, anywhere. So if you don't have the expertise in a country, it used to be national oil companies needed, and they still, many of them still need a lot of what they get from our international oil companies, but a lot of them have become very sophisticated and moved not only from their own backyard but into the Gulf of Mexico or elsewhere. And for those that aren't quite as sophisticated, they ask the service companies to provide a lot of services that they used to get from the oil companies. So we're asked to provide solutions for their problems, and that's what people do now in the service companies. Just thought I'd show you our technology and infrastructure investment. On the left side, you know, how much we spend on engineering and research. Really, as I said, the service companies are technology leaders. A guy was very kind and generous to say we are the leader. We would say we're one of the leaders. There are people who are bigger than us, but we're one of the two major service companies based in the United States who are U.S. resident companies and subject to U.S. taxes, whereas some of our competitors, even those who have a lot of people here in the U.S., are not resident U.S. taxpayers. So it makes a difference, I can tell you. Our major focus is on two things, technology and people. And without one, we don't have the other. And clearly, without the people, we don't have anything. So we spend a lot of money on technology, and you'll see we're going to continue to spend money on engineering and research, and most of our research is based on new products that we hope to introduce over time. And then our total CapEx, you can see, is going to fall off, but we're not falling off on engineering and research, because to be in the game for the long term, you have to continue to make the investments in your people. And I'd say this is a good proxy for the major service companies, that they're still going to be doing things the same way. We're going to build out the infrastructure where we need to have it all around the world. And we're going to continue to hire brand new engineers coming out of school and continue to educate the PhDs and engineers that we have. Give you an example, over 20 years, if you look on the left side, doing a S-shaped well, as we called it, using 2D seismic was a real big challenge 20 years ago. That was very tough to do. On the right-hand side, these are standard complex 3D wells that happen today, where you can bring the drill string down all over the place, know where it is, geosteer it, and hit within a couple feet of where you want to be, thousands or literally miles under the ground, after already going down because you're out in the sea and then down under the ground. So the technology is very different. And that leads to a lot of different things. One, we've got to have people who are very sophisticated because they use high technology every single day and have to be able to do things. You know, a directional single-shot survey in the Gulf of Mexico in 1980, you had a certain level of expertise. Today, to look at 2D, 3D, and actually 4D modeling and geosteering, you know, in the Middle East is something our people are called on to do in real time all the time. They have to be very sophisticated. And because of that, we can unlock these so-called, and I'd agree with Adam, I'm not sure they're unconventional anymore. They're becoming conventional. But where I showed you that S-shaped well 20 years ago and how hard that was, you can now see wells in the unconventional, such as the shale oil plays, where you can drill a totally horizontal section. You can shut it off. You can produce from different zones. You can control the pressures and do what you need to do in order to access that resource and produce it where previously it was thought that would never be producible. I thought I'd give you one example in particular that's pretty interesting, and that's the Troll field that many of you would recall. When first discovered, people said, well, gee, this isn't going to work economically. I don't know how we're going to do this. And now it is. And it is, you know, the estimated recoverability now is 1.9 billion barrels from that area. gives you a timeline. And I think this also reinforces the recovery estimate. If you look in, on the left-hand curve, the recovery estimate is 70%. I'm not sure how many people keep in the top of their mind that most oil fields, less than half of it's recovered. And historically, less than 40% is recovered. So if you can get 70% recovery out of the same field that you're only going to get 40% with old technologies, you know, you've got a lot more oil that can be produced. Natural gas is more than half, but you have the opportunity to increase recoverability there through technology as well. On the right-hand side is just an example of a single lateral that went out and branched into five, but they have in the troll field up to seven branch wells. And this is actually to scale, a single one that goes out, and if it happened to be, if New York City happened to be underground, I'm a native Washingtonian, but I still like New York enough that I won't suggest that's a good idea. But if New York happened to be underground at these depths, you know, and this is thousands of feet, this is what one well can go out with laterals and do, and there are multiple ones like that. This is what technology lets you do. Every day in the oil field service business, we do things that would amaze people more than the guys going up in space on the International Space Station, because the technology is very tough but very well applied. Our people are different. Left-hand side, probably the classic image of what guys from the tech, from the oil field look like. And I'm sure it's your eyes. I actually look like that, but you just can't tell at the distance. We do still have a lot of guys who look like that. But frankly, we have more and more people. We have over 100 nationalities at Baker Hughes, and there are, people are located all around the world. We have hundreds of PhDs. We have many, many engineers. These are very sophisticated people, and the place where most of our people work who make decisions looks more like the right-hand side today, because we do a lot of the work in real time, but out in offices, even including whether we're in Houston or Aberdeen or Dubai or in China, wherever they are, looking at wells through the systems that we have that show you what's happening, and they can make changes to wells right from their computer screens, and do every day. Here's one of the problems, though. As we talk about demand supply, we talk about a recovering demand for oil and gas eventually. What will happen with regard to employment? Employment went way up. We had to hire a lot of people. Costs obviously went up. Efficiencies did go down. So, you know, the price of drilling, as Susan showed on one of hers, and extracting was much more. So the six largest oil field service companies added 112,000 employees in a five-year period. So they increased employment 64%. But just this year so far, those same companies have announced 23,000 reductions, so an 8% decline from the peak employment that we have. We hope we won't see the same mistakes that we've had in prior cycles, because new engineers coming out, although the whole economy doesn't offer a lot of opportunity, but you come out, you have expectations for your career and future. If that doesn't come out well, you may say, I don't want to be there. And we need to have these people with high technology skills and abilities to really provide the market what is needed going forward. So some of the negative forces at play in a downturn, you know, management gets very distracted, both on the oil company side and the service company side, from how much technology is worth to them. Particularly the exploration production companies may say, you know, we just want to get this out. We may be slower to adopt new technology from the E&P side, which then slows down the pipeline of new technologies. Technology budgets go down, you get layoffs, and that's both at the oil companies and at the service companies. And as the oil companies are pushed to control prices and want to get that cost structure down, they turn over to their pricing groups and acquisition groups, their supply chain, say, just get the price down, just get it down, and don't pay anything for technology, just get it down. That can hurt significantly. So my final slide is that, you know, while we have cycles up and down, West Texas here is the crude oil price, we continue with that solid blue line. We're going to continue investing in people and technology. We're still hiring engineers. We're still hiring PhDs because we plan to be in the business a long time. A lot of the smaller companies don't have the technology to start with. They're not going to be able to do that. Some of them may not survive, but the larger ones are going to have to continue to provide places for people to work who have the skill base and provide them with the resource so that we can continue to develop the technology and gain all the resource that there is. Guy, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Those three excellent presentations, which inform this issue and in particular cover that spectrum from Adam's macroeconomic and demand side through the on-the-ground experience of the a very large service company. And it was very clear, I think, from all three that the economic downturn and financial credit crunch have already had an impact and will continue to have an impact. But it's not all bad news. There were some good news about cost reductions, improved productivity, and there are variances among the classes of types of companies. So thank you very much. Well, we're ready to hear from you and your questions, but while you're thinking of a question, I had one from Adam on the capital availability side. I didn't hear, and I from the banks, from your bank's perspective or the financial industry, whether credit availability, are you getting a sense that credit availability is having a large impact? Susan mentioned that it has on certain class of companies, the smaller to medium-sized independents. What's been your, if you can't talk about Deutsche Bank specifically, and more generally what you're picking up on that?
Yeah, I actually don't have figures for Deutsche Bank. I mean, I do know that there have been all of the banks, obviously, have credit issues and are deleveraging. Now, when you deleverage, you're looking for less risk, and then that brings in what gets referred to as counterparty issues. So you look at who you are lending money to and what the prospects are that you're going to get repaid. And that has tightened up. It's tightened up at Deutsche Bank. It's tightened up everywhere. I guess the interesting part about this is that with demand down as much as it is, the drop in credit availability is not having as great an impact as it would if the economy were doing better and it was just the banks that were in trouble. So I've never really felt that from a longer term perspective that credit availability was that much of an issue. There have been a lot of headlines that you see about the lack of capital, but generally speaking, capital is available for projects that have decent rates of return. So if there's a good project, that finds capital. And what happens is we see, I suspect that drop in of 21% in upstream spending in general or 38% in renewable spending is probably telling you that the least desirable projects are getting cut off. And so in a sense, it really shouldn't be that much of a surprise that renewables have been hit harder than conventional, oil and gas, simply because I think we all know that the investments in renewables at lower oil prices and gas prices are probably going to be more risky than others. So, I think, Guy, the answer is that, well, yeah, it's kind of a problem, but not anything that's insurmountable. Presumably, prices will again rise to a level sufficient to generate capital in the area. In fact, it reminds me, it's the one thing that I really just don't understand when I read the headlines in the papers, and it comes back to this issue of many people complaining that the rise in oil prices or gasoline prices over the course of the last 6 months has been somehow manipulation in the markets. And my feeling is that, well, look, there's been a lot of work done, and I think Susan had some numbers up there. You know, what does it actually cost to get oil out of the ground? You know, if you want to go put your money into a new oil project in the oil sands in Canada, or if you want to drill a deep water well in the Gulf of Mexico or partner up with somebody and get involved in Brazil or Angola or somewhere else, what does it actually cost? And the answer is, you know, even with cost reductions, probably at least $75 a barrel. Right? So my question is, you know, well, not why did oil go from 35 to 65 today? The question really ought to be, well, who was giving it away for $35, and why would you do that? Right? And if the answer is, well, there wasn't enough demand, and there was a lot of competition, and operating costs, you know, cash operating costs are lower. Well, I understand that, but, you know, from a longer-term perspective, that just doesn't work. You can't sell any product. You can't, you know, this. You can't sell a tie for less than what it costs you to make it. You can if you're in a distressed situation, but from a longer-term perspective, prices have to go up to replacement costs. And replacement costs, unless we have some new technological breakthrough, are probably at least $60, maybe $80. And you know, a year ago, we were talking about replacement costs being closer to $100 a barrel.
Thank you, Adam. Lou Pulirisi from Epring. I think there's a mic coming, Lou. Over.
I have a question for probably Susan and Alan. Alan, on the shale gas, I think it's really interesting because we built all these shale, not necessarily we, but some people built receiving facilities for LNG. And so obviously they didn't see this coming, this huge turnaround in shale. And I presume it's partly art and partly technology. But I'm wondering if you see this worldwide, the shale being a worldwide phenomenon, in which we may see gas decoupling from oil, not just in the U.S., but worldwide. Just get your observation of that. And the second one is we see the investment coming down, but presumably we're picking up some of that in the sense that the costs are lower. So the effective investment is not as bad as the chart looks, I'm guessing from that. And my final question is one on taxation. The Obama administration is proposing a bunch of taxes which appear, if you read the Treasury Green Book, appear to be targeted right at the smaller independents that do this E&P work. And if you read the Green Book, it says they're doing this because we're overinvesting on gas and it's not good for carbon loadings and we need to go to a more neutral stance. But I'm just wondering if you have any evidence where the Treasury did any modeling on that or what their thinking was, because if you read the Green Book, you have a sense they don't understand that we import oil, and that was sort of the end of my comment.
You know, I speak to the shale gas. I think I can do that fairly quickly. People are looking all around the world as to whether or not the geology supports similar progress, because we do have the technology to produce those wells. So whether it be in Hungary or certain other places, they are examining that possibility. And I'll turn it all over to Susan, although I would say we do see from our clients hesitation, the smaller independents, to make investment commitments because of the uncertainty in the taxes. And you're right, if gas, which is a fairly clean fuel on a relative basis, certainly on the hydrocarbon basis, very clean fuel, isn't brought forward in the U.S., it'll come from somewhere else, whether it's LNG from the Middle East, and we end up more dependent on the same sources as we do for oil.
Thank you. Also comment that in the cost sector includes taxes. Right? So cost matter is all costs. And one of the reasons you saw the lower investment returns in Norway was basically because of corporate income taxes. So, yeah, of course, there's great concern about the investment opportunity here in the U.S. As far as shale goes and global gas prices, there are really two countries in which there is a gas-on-gas market that is determining prices. That's the U.S. and the U.K. In general, and the rest, as you well know, it's more of an oil-based pricing. But the one interesting thing about the regas terminals, which were, looked at in the early 2000s, which is when they were planned and started to be built, was that was before the prolific nature of the unconventional gas was known. And secondly, however, in this particular year, one of the outcomes of the global crisis is that if you look at Japan and Korea, they consume 55% of the world's LNG. And they have had tremendous downturn in the demand in a year in which there were also newly contracted long-term contracts for LNG coming into Japan. So there's a certain amount of – you don't shut down an LNG plant, as you saw from those other charts. There's quite a bit of uncontracted spot LNG, and there are only really two places for it to go this year. One is the U.K., and the other is for storage, and the other is the U.S. So in spite of the fact we have a low gas price at the moment, there is still LNG flowing into the U.S. Because it's the place it can go for storage.
I think first Bob McNally, then up front here.
Bob McNally with Tudor Investment, an excellent panel. There's a point of view that in addition to being higher, oil prices may be more volatile going forward. There won't be a producer or a group of producers withholding sufficient spare capacity and using it to balance the market. If indeed oil price volatility is going to be much higher in the future, very interested, especially from Susan and Alan, but really everybody, how will industry, the drilling industry, respond to that and manage the risks of that increased volatility in prices? Thank you.
Wow. I was waiting for somebody else to give a good answer to that. All right, before I'm left brain, right brain. While my left brain is thinking to the answer to that question, I just want to make one quick, really quick comment on Lou's question about shale gases. One, it's really interesting. If you looked at that slide that Susan put up, the focus companies, the little ones, are the ones that have developed a shale play, right? So anything that you do from a legislative standpoint that puts the smaller companies, those companies, at some kind of a tax disadvantage is really not a good idea. Particularly if you want to broaden this out. And the second thing is, I'm back to Dr. Schlesinger. He told us a long time ago about the issues that Europe would have with Gazprom, and I think there was a period there of about a decade where nobody believed it, and I think we're now believers again, aren't we? It would be transformational. If it really does appear as though the geology for shale gases in Europe is just fine. And if that could be developed in Europe, it would be transformational from the standpoint of Europe's dependence on Gazprom for gas imports. And I suspect that the whole LNG and gas shale thing is going to give a – if you talk to anybody about energy security in Europe anymore, they don't talk about oil anymore. All they talk about is gas. All right, now, Bob. So we were – your question – remind me again.
Volatility.
Volatility. Yeah. Volatility, right. Okay, so what are we going to do about volatility? Actually, measured volatility has come down since the beginning of the year. So oil volatility is much less now than it was in the period when prices were rapidly collapsing, and the rise that we've had has actually been a relatively steady one. There's three ways that you usually deal with volatility. You have a strategic petroleum reserve. I think that it was not managed very well in the prior administration. I think there was a reluctance to use it when it was probably would have been a good idea to use it a bit more actively. There are, I think, ways that the SPR could be used in coordination with markets to take some of that cost away from the government. And then secondly, another way you deal with volatility is we have OPEC. I mean, OPEC gets this – a lot of bad press, you know, a cartel is trying to control oil prices and pushing them up now by holding production back. You could argue that OPEC is trying to do everybody a favor by getting oil prices back to replacement cost levels, which might save the renewable energy industry. And then the third way of doing it is...
Right.
The third way of doing this is really quite simple. If you see me after the program, I'll give you the name of our trading desk in New York, and you can hedge. Producers can sell forward, consumers can buy forward, and I don't really think to me that's not speculation. Speculation gets a bad rap. It's manipulation is bad. Anybody that's manipulating the markets, if it can be shown that manipulation is taking place, that ought to be illegal and they ought to go to jail. Speculation is something that adds liquidity, and in the past, every academic study that's ever been done on speculative activity in the positive sense of the word is that it reduces volatility. So we should have more speculation, not less speculation. And finally, back to the SPR for just a second. There may not be enough physical oil around to accommodate the number of people who would like to invest in it. And for the life of me, I do not understand why the federal government doesn't allow the public to invest in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. I would love to have 100 barrels of oil sitting in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve that's got my name on it. And if the government decides to sell it 2 years from now, if there's a geopolitical problem, I get the $200 that it sells for if I paid to put it in at $75 a barrel. So what's wrong with that idea? You know, it's like they're not being very creative in thinking about ways to manage the volatility.
I think that was sufficient. Kevin Book?
Kevin Book from Clearview Energy Partners. Thank you, panelists, and thank you for a very passionate panel as well. I guess this is sort of a related question to the replacement cost question, and also treats the topic of markets. There's a notion that there may be too much money in oil markets. My question is really for those, for PFC and for the services business, and for you, Adam. What does it take? How many times the world oil market over worth of cash has to be trading in financial barrels before producers feel secure about making investments? So how much liquidity? I was asked a question by a member of Congress. Do we need 30 times the amount of oil that's traded trading? Is that too much? You know, 30 seems like too many. Well, maybe it should be 50, as Adam may have suggested. Do you see signals on the part of producers that they respond to that say that, wow, there's a lot of cash out there. We better start producing. Is it really a signal? Does it happen soon enough to see? Have you seen it? Thank you.
We make some comments about investment decisions, I think. And maybe it will answer that, and then we can see who else can answer too. Companies making decisions really get nervous with the level of volatility that we had last year. There's no doubt about it. But as you saw from some of the slides, there are threshold numbers that are used and necessary in order to make investment decisions. We had gotten to the point last year where, in spite of the fact the price had risen so much, the cost had risen so much, that margins were eroding. Very hard to explain, really hard to explain, to not only the street, but if you're a national oil company, it's very hard to explain to your finance minister. Prices have gone up that much, but you don't have that much profit. Very hard. They take the money anyway. So the fact that if prices stay above the $60 or around $60, you can start to see thresholds back descend, or rather planning numbers descend back. And there is an awful lot of new capacity coming on in end of 2009, 2010, 2011, all throughout the industry, which is going to keep all sorts of prices down. There is OPEC brought on 4.5 million barrels a day between 2004 and the end of next year, which is either it's under construction or it's already there. And being an old oil field services person myself, I think it's the first time I remember that OPEC actually did the same thing the service companies generally do, which is invest right at the time the demand drops. So there's an awful lot of excess capacity going to be sitting there. On the service side, real laggards, because they got so burned for a 15-year period, nobody made any investments. So big investments coming on in drilling rigs and all sorts of industry sectors, which is going to keep prices down for some years as well. So as you look forward as an executive making an investment decision, you see a period, sure, with more with volatility because of the financial players, but you at least are starting to see more wiggle room in terms of the environment that you can understand the fundamentals of as we go forward.
Frank, Frank Verastro.
Talked about this. So when the price of oil went up, the costs also went up. Costs have started to come down. But for the service industry, what's the lag time? Because you put people in place, you've trained them, You've got drilling equipment. Is it, I think Andrew Gould thought it was 14 months for a new price structure to be put in place given old contracts, but you renegotiate contracts all the time. So can we expect a commensurate reduction in costs that would then make your price threshold, Susan, better? You know, lower oil prices still work because your costs are lower.
Frank and I are old friends, so I knew he'd pick on me at some point. The it depends on the market where, you know, how quickly the price responds from the service sector side. I mean, we have published prices. We have contracts in place. And we look very closely at how much of our work is under contract. But notwithstanding it's under contract, you can have some of the very big IOCs or NOCs who come to you and say, you know, you want to stick to the contract, that's interesting, but what do you want to do next year? And you renegotiate. So prices can change dramatically and have, frankly, fairly quickly. And that's just in the part we play in. So drilling rigs, you know, a lot of the offshore rigs and the very sophisticated and very expensive are under contracts. They are, I can say from another perspective, they are holding to those contracts because they need that cash flow or expect that cash flow. And you can buy your way out of it if you want and you know, monetize that, which we know.
Oh, John Chagas. Probably resents those remarks that Adam made about the SPR.
Love the comments, Adam. Alan, back in 2007, pretty much what I was hearing was that the industry couldn't buy talent at any price, that the colleges could not churn out engineers fast enough as the price of oil went over $100 a barrel. If in 2010 the price is at $100 a barrel and rising, is it going to be a repeat of that situation where your costs are going to be going through the roof, or are the universities starting to churn out people commensurate with a much higher price of oil?
Well, I think if oil immediately went back to $100 a barrel, you could have a challenge again with getting the people that you need with the skill base you need. It takes at least 2 years, frankly, for us when we take somebody out of school as a BS engineering graduate or even somebody with a master's to actually be productive in the way and send them out in the field where they're really in charge of something. So there is a lag time just on that. That's why the last slide I had showed we're going to continue hiring people because we do think long-term there's going to be that demand need. Whether there'll be enough people, you know, if prices spike up and you have that kind of situation, really heavy cyclical, you run a risk the same way. I can tell you that in the last few years, you say you couldn't buy enough people. I can tell you many of our competitors sure did a good job of buying a lot of our people away and did that quite successfully, many of whom are now knocking on our door again, I must say, but that's a different issue. So we are committed to that long term.
Yes, in the back row, please.
Ginsburg with the Independent Petroleum Association. One of the other legislative threats is this derivatives legislation that would pretty much do away with over-the-counter swaps. Given that the oil and gas industry isn't exactly the most sympathetic face on Capitol Hill, I think the only one that may be worse is banks, how do you go up and argue that that would be a very dangerous thing for them to do? Because it was just part of the Waxman-Markey bill that was passed.
I think really it has to come from end users. I mean, you're looking at the banks are the intermediary in these deals. Oil companies and gas companies are the one end of the transaction. The other end is users. Airlines who want to hedge jet fuel, companies that want to hedge the cost of their fuels that they use in manufacturing and so on. And I think that probably in order to make any headway at all with the congressional leaders on this, it's going to have to come from those people that would say, well, wait a minute, this is how we use these products, and it's a legitimate use of things. I think that there's a big misunderstanding of exactly how those markets work and what they are. More transparency is probably a good idea, and Deutsche Bank has supported moves at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission to do that. I think the idea of trying to force all of these derivative products onto exchanges, which is one of the extreme ideas, just simply isn't, I mean, it wouldn't work. It will just kind of stop the use of them. Just as an example, in the early days of carbon trading in Europe, many of the successful products that actually helped to get greenhouse gases off the market, controlled in some way, were kind of one-on-one deals between producers of those greenhouse gases and people that wanted the credits associated with it, with banks standing again as intermediaries, and those products would never have been developed. So I think that the Congress may, I think in their concern and, you know, legitimate worry about the abuses that took place, they may end up going way much further than is desired. And as I said, I think the only way to really deal with that credibly from a political perspective is for the people that actually use the products to speak up and say, God, don't do that.
Let me say very quickly, since I'm on the board of a company that uses those products, God, don't do that.
Right up front here.
Leonard Oberlander, independent consultant. As a segue from the derivatives, it just occurs that there's a delivery to be made for those that will take delivery. And my question is first about the vessels, the ships that will transport the liquids, and pipelines that will transport the fuels. Those that are in existence and those that are planned, and where the resources are for those and the strategies, how does that impact the discussion in a way parallel to the way you explained the drilling and development? Is there a parallel with pipelines and tankers? And secondly, in the discussion about taxes and trying to stabilize international prices through tax policies, it occurred to me that Russian Federation taxes oil revenues, not profits, and then redistributes those revenues to other sectors. How do you treat stabilization when U.S. tax by changing U.S. tax policies in certain ways, when such a large factor as the Russian Federation's oil is taxed on the basis of revenues?
I'm happy to speak a little bit about the pipelines and the LNG vessels, receiving terminals, gasification or regasification and liquefaction. I mean, there are, I think Adam and Susan both spoke to, you know, more LNG may come to the U.S., but our projections show that it's still not going to come anywhere near the capacity that's already here, so there's plenty of capacity to receive and regasify. It's more a storage issue, frankly, on gas at the moment. And there's plenty of receiving facilities also that have been built and are ready to go, as well as ones that are being built throughout Western Europe. And, of course, as Susan made reference, the Koreans and Japanese take the vast majority of LNG today, so there's plenty there. There are lots of pipeline issues going to the old great game, trying to bring it out of the former Soviet Union, and those are still a lot of issues going on. But in the end, if you have a resource and you can't get it to market, it's not a valuable resource.
It's time for one more question.
Guy, let me just 30 seconds on that. In President Putin's first term, they made a lot of, I think, sensible decisions about how to tax oil and how to deal with that, and the result was is that they got a big increase in oil production. And by the time we got to President Putin's second term, a lot of those policies were reversed, and interestingly, oil production began to slip, and I think last year it actually fell for the first time in 10 years. So taxation really does make a difference, and it makes a difference whether it's in Russia or anywhere else. You know, bottlenecks like shipping, you mentioned shipping. I remember, I think it was 2005, there seemed to be a problem with both oil tankers and LNG tankers, and that actually got solved pretty quickly. So there's no problem. That Baltic Dry Freight Index is telling you there's plenty of shipping capacity available. It doesn't really deal with oil, but the picture in oil is the same, where you're using oil tankers to store oil. Right. So I think that you have to come back to something that I said earlier, and that is that the infrastructure gets built if the return is appropriate to put the investment into that infrastructure. We built a lot of refineries, and now we're going to have surplus refining capacity. There is surplus oil production capacity. But you can have regional issues. There's a problem with pipelines getting this prolific gas out of the Haynesville, so the Texas-Louisiana border needs more pipelines, and I presume that those are going to get built, assuming that the returns are there. If you think about electricity and some of the other issues that we'll have over the next few years, I've heard the group here at CSIS, you know, talk incessantly and issue warnings about the idea of we need to get the proper regulation in place that allows construction of electric transmission lines and probably, you know, carbon dioxide pipelines and whatever else is going to be required as we look out into the future. And if we don't have the proper regulatory framework for dealing with those issues, that's probably going to be more of a problem than raising the capital.
Vicki Bailey? Last question goes to...
Thank you, Guy. Vicki Bailey, independent consultant. And as someone who sits on a board of directors of a company that is very involved in the shale gas play, I think it was Susan, I think maybe you had the slide that talked about the majors and the independents, and there may not be as many independents, you know, as we go along. My issue goes to mergers and acquisitions. Do you see any interest from the standpoint of majors or other entities or any partnering or acquisitions or mergers that might be on the horizon?
The slide I showed was what happened last time. There was a big downturn, 1995, and you saw in one of the charts that was the last big drilling downturn as well. The majors and international players are very interested in unconventional gas in the U.S. Right? They're not very big participants now, so of course I would say a number of them are looking. The question, I think, for them is the materiality issue. How do you get in, and it's for any of their investments? You saw how large they are, the big players. But there's a whole series of slightly larger independents as well, which don't have the same scale problem, meaning if you get into the shale and the unconventional, you get in basins. You're not buying a company that has a huge play all across the United States. So the question of where to go, I think, is an interesting one. Do we expect there will be acquisition activity? Absolutely, yes, because it's so prolific. It's a long-term play. The question, I think, for the larger ones would be, can it be big enough to be material? And how do you get in and make an investment which is going to be the right one, given the very big differences in the success of different companies, given their ability to have the right wells, as you saw, the big difference in the experience factor.
Well, thank you very much. Once again, thank you all for coming. It's been a great afternoon. And thanks, Susan, Alan, Adam, thank you.